Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, I'm curious to know whether you think that Israel's prime minister is going to be a candidate for a Nobel Prize, Nobel Peace Prize, no less.
It's a good question. I don't put very much stock in the Nobel Peace Prize, so I'm going to go for no, even though it seems like suddenly people say he's doing a really good job at this mediation thing.
Well, I mean, we're talking about the mediation. There was that Shabbat Saturday trip that Prime Minister Naftali Bennett made to Vladimir Putin, becoming the first Western leader to meet with the embattled invader of Ukraine, the president of Russia, in Moscow on Saturday, then flew to Berlin on Saturday night to meet with Olaf Scholz, the relatively new chancellor, came back to Israel, held conversations with Zelensky. I think in the last few days, been four or five of those calls, a number of calls with Putin. Reports coming out that the
Macron also.
Yes, and reports are coming out that the mediation is actually doing something. So what do you make of all of this? Why is Israel at all involved in a conflict that it has nothing to do with it?
So you and I think we're both pretty skeptical for a while, but Zelensky has been asking Israel to mediate for about a year now, and more than a year, I think, at this point. Twice Netanyahu offered Putin, once Putin directly and another time Putin's people, and they rejected. Once Bennett offered in October when he met with Putin and Putin rejected it. Now Putin is more, has been open to it, sort of. I was skeptical all along, but the reasoning is that basically Israel's like the only democratic country that has good relations with both countries. That's the theory. That's what Zelensky's been saying. And that's what a bunch of other people have been saying since then. And I think that at first, like Bennett himself and just, you know, his advisors and his government, they were all pretty skeptical. Like, why do we need to be involved in something, you know, that has nothing to do with us, like you were saying. But Bennett clearly became convinced that he is in a unique position in order to help, you know, and you know, if you could stop a war and save lives, like that's a good thing. So somehow Bennett is doing this now. And my understanding is he's not a mediator in the sense of like putting things on the table and being like, you know, oh, you want to compromise on this? Okay, then the other side should compromise on this. He's not like actively mediating in that way. And in a way, Bennett is even more like mediating between Putin and the West than Putin and Zelensky. Like he is the sort of way that people like Scholz and Macron and I think Boris Johnson as well, even though there haven't been readouts of those calls, he's like their window into what Putin is thinking right now, what he's willing to do in order to reach a ceasefire with Ukraine.
I know, but you know, my problem with that, Lahav, is that the Prime Minister of Israel is not meant to be
a
diplomat for the West that's meant to get them, you know, information of what's happening inside the head of Vladimir Putin, right? You wrote a very interesting analysis the other day where you looked at Bennett's character and what we know about him since he entered politics back in, what was it, 2012, 2013, and how he's approached different issues, whether it was the Gaza Strip tunnels back in Operation Protective Edge in 2014, the way he jumped into the COVID-19 crisis back when he was defense minister, even wrote a book of how to defeat a pandemic, the way he jumped headfirst into this. And you kind of hinted at some criticism or even said it quite, I would say, outright, that Naftali Bennett doesn't always think things through. He goes after something, but it's not always thought out till the end. Is that accurate?
We had a conversation earlier this week where there's a Hebrew word that people keep using about him, paziz. And between me and you, we were like, what's the best word for that? I was saying, the word is rash. He makes rash decisions. I think he has like qualities that are good qualities in a leader, but also need to be put in check, and they're not put in check. So like, for example, like I think he's very creative. He likes to think outside the box, and that's good. But when he gets these ideas and he thinks there's a good idea, he won't hear anyone else telling him like this might not work or tone it down or stop, you know, like he gets like a tunnel vision. And so I do think that there's a chance, like, even though he was hesitant at the beginning, I think, with these diplomatic efforts, he's now, like, really jumped into it headlong, like, as if he's going to save the world. And what I'm saying to you, like, about, you know, him being more almost like a go-between between Putin and the West, even more than Putin and Zelensky, and that's because the Ukrainians and Russians actually do have a direct channel. But that's something that Western diplomats are saying. It's not coming from the prime minister's office, because I don't think that that's how Bennett sees himself. I think he sees himself as really being the person. I don't know if he thinks he's going to bring peace, but I think he sees himself as really trying to bring peace. There's some irony there, too.
I have no doubt that in his mind, what he's doing is right, and that he feels that there is a possibility to save lives and to spare conflict, and that's what this is about for him, right?
Yeah, I don't think that it's about a Nobel Peace Prize for Bennett. Like, I don't think that's...
No,
yeah.
I don't think it's about a Nobel Peace Prize either. No, come on. Yeah. Let's have a little fun with this, no, if it's possible. But I do think that he does... see, I think, like all politicians, that maybe there's an upside to this. He's terrible. He's at rock bottom in the polls. And maybe playing the role of a diplomat could bring some benefit, right? I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you one benefit it brings. And I have to give credit to my colleague Ariel Kahana from Yisrael Hayom, who thought of this, which is to say that it does relieve pressure on Israel to put sanctions on Russia and to follow all the steps the West has taken against Russia, because there was some pressure in the beginning, right? And now it's like, well, he needs to be the mediator. If he antagonizes Russia too much, then Putin won't talk to him. So that's an immediate plus size.
Interesting.
Plus side.
So... yeah. How does this play out from Israel's perspective? I mean, we see, for example, lots of Ukrainian olim, new immigrants have been coming here. The Ayelet Shaked, Israel's interior minister, who had been tough on refugees, announced on Tuesday that Israel will be allowing in 25,000 Ukrainian refugees for a temporary period, which is a huge number from an Israeli perspective, especially considering that in the beginning they didn't want to let anyone in. So that's a big turnaround for Israel. Where did that change come from?
Okay, so first of all, if we parse the numbers, about 20 out of those 25,000 are Ukrainians who are already in Israel. There's a lot of Ukrainians that are in Israel either working legally or working illegally. And pretty much from like the second or third day of the war, Shaked had already agreed that they were going to let these people like overstay their visas as long as the war is going on. So that's the vast majority of those people. I'm not discounting it. I'm not knocking it. You know, like they shouldn't be deporting those people during the war. But then they'll allow in an additional 5,000 people. But also, I think when people talk about 25,000 refugees, it's like acting like, you know, Jews don't exist or Jews aren't people. Because the fact is that we're going to be accepting tens of thousands, if not 100,000 more refugees from Ukraine. They just happen to be Jews or relatives of Jews, and therefore their status will be, you know, they're qualified for immigration instead of just temporarily being here as refugees. So I think that Israel is being... 25,000 is a lot, and we are being even more magnanimous beyond that. You know, I mean, and I don't think like, you know, Israel accepting Aliyah is a favor, right? Like that's literally why we exist, to help Jews who are in trouble. But I do think that the criticism and even just I feel like the story is often being told in a way that doesn't include that essential context, because it will be pretty difficult absorbing tens of thousands more people. You know, anyway, beyond those 25,000, it's still a drain on our resources, and one that I'm happy, and I'm sure many other Israelis are proud that we are doing, but it should be, you know, it should be told as one story, I think.
So Lahav, when we were talking ahead of the podcast, you know, there's a lot of usage of Holocaust terms, right? In this war and in the rhetoric, we hear from the Russians about the denazification of Ukraine. We hear from the Ukrainians, alleged allegations that Russia bombed Babi Yar, the memorial site, which turned out not to be true.
Not exactly.
Everybody's kind of using the Holocaust card. You hear people who refer to Putin as the modern day Hitler. What do you make of all of that?
I really don't like use of Holocaust comparisons for anything other than genocide, basically. Maybe ethnic cleansing fits it, but like... And I think, I mean, obviously Putin saying that he's denazifying Ukraine is absurd, right? Ukraine has a Jewish president. Until recently, it also had a Jewish prime minister. Their defense minister is also Jewish. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not to say that they don't have a long history of anti-Semitism, but that's not where the country is today. And even I see certain like media reports that are maybe a little bit more pro-Russian that are citing this group called Azov, which is like a militia slash political party, but they got less than 2% of the vote in the last election. And they're estimated to have 10,000 members in a country of 40 million people. So that's like not a reason to invade a country to quote unquote denazify it. But on the other hand, you know, the Ukraine is using images of the Holocaust, like in order to describe its victimhood, which they are victims, but it is not a genocide happening. And they keep using that word genocide. Just this week, Zelensky compared like Ukraine, what's happening in Ukraine to the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, you know, and I just find it very inappropriate. Like, this is a war being fought with conventional weapons. It's a horrible war and there's no justification for it. But not every war is the Holocaust.
No, not every war is the Holocaust, but it sells, right? It attracts attention. It's a catchphrase. It gets people to focus. I mean, you know, when one of Zelensky's advisors tweeted that evening about the bombing of Babi Yar, we all jumped, right? Everybody jumped and assumed that that's what was happening.
Yes.
But what we were learning as reporters, and I think as the media throughout this conflict, is that there's a ton of false flags, lots of disinformation. Everybody is manipulating everybody. And you know, the Russians are experts at that, by the way. They're experts.
Of course.
Yeah.
I disagree, by the way, that the Babi Yar bombing didn't happen, because that there's like a big statue and memorial wall and whatever, and that's still standing. But Babi Yar, I mean, there were 100,000 people buried there. It's like a very big area, and that area was bombed. So like the Russians are showing the picture of the sculpture of the, like, you know, memorial statue to say, look, it's still there. But I still think, like, you know, Babi Yar is a forest.
I mean, I'm also referring to what Ron Ben Ishai, who's a colleague of ours from Idiota Hornot, who's there in Kiev.
Right. And he was referring the site to and the, said, he was showing,
said that nothing had been damaged.
Yeah. But he was referring to a very narrow site. I saw that. I think that it's, I think he's looking at it in a very narrow lens.
Either way, when it comes to Babi Yar, there is the disinformation campaign that is being managed and run by both sides here. And we see that, by the way, with the Ukrainian ambassador who keeps on inviting you and other reporters to press conferences in Tel Aviv, wears a helmet one day, cries another day. I'm not saying it's not legitimate, but there's a big use of the media to get messages across, to put pressure on different governments, to sway public opinion. It's an interesting tactic that we're seeing really in this conflict, I think, that we might not have seen, for example, in Israeli conflicts in the past.
Yeah, that is true. We have not been as good at that. But the ambassador had a better comparison, I think, that he made, which is that he said that this is comparable to the Yom Kippur War. And that made more sense to me than, you know, than the Holocaust. And what's interesting also is that a lot of Ukrainians see Golda Meir as a hero because she was born in Kiev. And there was this video going around online of Ron Ben Ishai, that same journalist you were talking about, who was speaking with a Ukrainian soldier who said, you're from Israel. My nickname is Zion. And he's like, why is your nickname Zion? And he's like, because I'm a Zionist. And then he opens up his backpack and takes out a biography of Golda Meir and says, I take this everywhere with me. So that's very interesting. And it's also interesting because, I mean, this is one soldier, but we've seen in things Zelensky has said and things many other people have said in Ukraine is that they compare their situation to Israel being surrounded by, you know, the powerful Arab armies that want to destroy it. And even though certain anti-Israel activists are trying to compare Ukraine to the Palestinians and Russia to Israel, I personally think that in reality, this conflict is nothing like the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. I mean, the comparison between Israel and Arab armies is also not great, but better than Israel and the Palestinians.
I think so for sure. You know, I met this week with I had a meal with university. I think the best way to call them would be diversity administrators from different colleges across New York State.
Oh, God.
And so people of minority themselves. And one of them said to me, you know, if I criticize Israel, I find I'm very leftist, very left wing, very progressive. But I feel that sometimes if I criticize Israel, I get accused of being an anti-Semite. So is it okay to criticize Israel? Is it not okay to criticize Israel? So one of the examples that I gave was our good friend Mehdi Hassan, who both you and I have sparred with on Twitter. I say good friend facetiously.
Yes.
Who has a show, I think, on MSNBC and Peacock News and elsewhere, who very early on in this conflict compared Israel to Russia and the Ukrainians to the Palestinians. And it was such an absurd comparison because, A, the Ukrainians haven't fired rockets or thousands of rockets at Russia. They haven't blown up buses and coffee shops in Russia. They've never threatened to push Russia into the sea and to destroy Russia. They never attacked Russia in five or six different wars. But what I explained to this person was that when people make those comparisons, that's not legitimate criticism of Israel. That's an obsession that, yes, becomes anti-Semitism, right? And that's this double standard, this delegitimization, the famous Natan Sharansky 3D test of delegitimization, demonization, double standard that you see people fall, you know, do and act on all the time. And I just used him as an example, but these comparisons are crazy, right? And they're used because they weaponize this stuff to undermine and to weaken the state of Israel.
Yeah. And by the way, I worry all of these things that are happening with Russia, all these businesses pulling out and these boycotts. And it's not to say that, like, I think a lot of it is justified, but I worry that that's going to be turned on Israel, or at least people will try to turn that on Israel, you know, in a few months or next time there's another war with Hamas. And the thing that I think sort of never has a justification really is the cultural boycotts. Like, I've been seeing all these things of, like, you know, Russian opera singer fired from the Metropolitan Opera in New York because she refuses to denounce Putin. Like, that's, to me, it's like, you can't call it racism because it's not about her race, but, like, let the woman sing opera, you know? And I feel the same when, like, an Israeli dance troupe shows up in, like, Scotland, and I'm like, let them dance, you know?
It's become really toxic, the whole, and anything that has to do with Russia today. And, you know, that's the way it is, for better or for worse. Lahav, you know, we speak later in the show with Professor Yossi Shein, who is from Yisrael Beiteinu, a member of Knesset. He's a pretty, I'd say, one of the Israel's premier experts in international affairs and political scientists, formerly of Tel Aviv University. Now he's a member of Knesset. And we speak about the Ukrainian conflict and the larger scale ramifications, not just for Israel, but also for the globe and for the world, right, of what this means for the world order and what will China do and how this will all play out. So that'll be interesting. But we also speak with our colleague Gil Hoffman, who's the veteran Jerusalem Post political analyst. And we speak about the Knesset breaking for recess this week after a long winter session. So Lahav, just kind of set that conversation up for us. Why would we care about the Knesset?
Well, I mean, I care about the Knesset all the time. I don't know about you, Yaakov, but
you used to spend a lot of time there. That's
right,
true.
Right, right. 8 years, but more than 8 years, actually. But right now, this government has this weird sort of bifurcation where, like, as an executive branch, it's functioning very well. But in the Knesset, it's completely dysfunctional and it, like, can't pass laws.
It's a great show, though. For people who understand Hebrew, turn on the Knesset channel every once in a while.
Yes.
I mean, it's entertaining. There's yelling, there's dancing, there's clapping. It's like a circus.
Yes, it's very entertaining. That is true. I don't know how great it is for governance, for trust in the government and things like that, but it's certainly been entertaining.
Oh, no, it's very sad, actually. Yeah. Yes.
But so, you know, they're breaking for recess, which means that we definitely won't have an election called for the next 2 months because they don't have to win any votes. But it's not looking great for the coalition. And so we thought we would invite Gil to explain what exactly is going on. Does this government have a future? And do we think Yair Lapid will actually become prime minister next year?
So stay tuned, folks. First, a conversation with Yossi Shane, the member of Knesset and professor of political science of Tel Aviv University and Georgetown, as he pointed out in our interview with him. And then a conversation with Gil Hoffman. Here we go.
This week on the podcast, we have member of Knesset Yossi Shane of the Israel Beiteinu party. He was also a professor of political science at Tel Aviv University for a long time and author of the recent book, The Israeli Century, How the Zionist Revolution Changed History and Reinvented Judaism. Thank you for being on the show.
It's a pleasure.
We brought you in here because you also have a lot to say about Israel's foreign policy, and it's an exciting week in that area. And I guess we could start with talking about how Israel is involved in mediation efforts now between Ukraine and Russia, which is sort of a unique position for Israel, not something that I think Israel's ever been involved in before. So what's your take on that?
Look, we are here in a very... Like everybody knows, we're in a very critical moment in international affairs. And we are in the midst of the events as they are unfolding. And the calamity that we see, the shifts in world affairs, what happened in the sites of what happened in Ukraine, the approach of the West toward Putin and Russia, all of this is really bringing us into a new posture, which we don't know yet how it will develop and what will happen. I would say that Israel has many concerns and interests and positions in light of what is happening, because the occurrences right now in Ukraine and in the war of Russia on Ukraine are not the only one that are taking place as we speak. There is, in conjunction with this, there is also a discussion in Vienna, and the idea of reaching an agreement on the nuclear Iran, and we are, of course, very much concerned for the life and well-being of many Israelis and many Jews, both in Ukraine, in Russia, and this is a momentous moment for us. And also as we go between the United States and Russia, because we have always had a very good working relation with America, of course. This is our number one ally, ideological ally, strategic ally. America and Israel goes, you know, like what we call special relations for two generations and more. With Russia, we have been in very good terms in recent years, in the last two decades or so or less, but around that time. And we also having very close relations with Ukraine. So all of this brings us into this condition when we have also concerns on our border in Syria, where Russia is playing a major role. So you know everything. It's all about where Israel is positioned vis-a-vis this conflict and vis-a-vis our concerns on the threats that are looming from Iran and of the concerns, the humanitarian concerns that we have, and of course the Israeli sort of Jewish component of all of this, in addition to the strategic and other interests.
On the other hand, Israel is getting itself involved, right? It's put itself in the middle. Prime Minister Bennett flew off to Moscow, then to Berlin, is talking with Zelensky, is talking to Putin. It seems that there's an Israeli role in mediation. On the other hand, though, it's not our conflict, right? Finally, there's a war that's not about Israel. Why should the country even get involved in this thing?
I think that it's not... We have, you know, like we have a position, a general position, where we didn't want kind of look to push ourselves into this. We you know, it's not our conflict. But yet, to ignore what is happening and to not get involved is because we did not push ourselves in that respect would be not taking responsibility. And I think this government and this prime minister and this foreign minister and us are definitely supporting a position that we must be proactive, proactive on the issue of Israelis and Jews, and proactive on the strategic concerns that we have. We cannot let go on the strategic concerns on the issue that are now unfolding in Ukraine, or for that matter, even more so, I don't know if more so, but obviously on the issue of Iran in Vienna. So we must be proactive. And if we have the role, and if we can play a role of not a go-between, but some leadership position where the Putin and the West is trusting us, and of course Zelensky, we should not shy away from this burden, because this may be a burden. Say, why do I need this? Why do I want to be there? Maybe they will blame us in the end of the day. We know this rhetoric, and indeed, it's always we don't want to be in the position that the messenger is guilty, so to speak. But I think leadership is all about the idea that if you are having interests and if you are having concerns, which run a huge kind of like as I described them already, numerous concerns and numerous kind of like really worries, you must be active. And if you are in a position of leadership that accepted all in all these capitals and in France and in Germany and in Washington and in Moscow, and of course in Kiev, as it is Kiev right now, what we see, this is the right thing to do for the prime minister and the foreign minister who is now in Riga. And I think otherwise we are not doing our mission as a government and as a coalition.
Just as a follow-up though on that one of the criticisms has been, and I felt this at least until this week, that Israel was not clear enough in its position, right? It was paying lip service to Ukraine and to saying that we are on the side of the West and we do support the US, but it was very parv, if we could call it that. The prime minister himself doesn't utter the words Russia or Putin in any form of condemnation. On the other hand, we did vote with the UN General Assembly. But Yair Lapid has condemned Russia. Are you satisfied with the position that the government has taken?
Look, it's clear to everybody's, you know, everybody who looks at this understands that, let's put it this way, the position of condemning Russia, condemning Putin, and just like condemning them is, of course, kind of like what the West have done in the United Nations, and we're condemning it. And there are much more to be condemned, as I say, much more to be condemned. And yet, and not yet as opposed to this, and yet, in addition, there are things whether we can advance certain things. It's not enough when you condemn and you just like condemn and then you cannot be involved and you're out of the game. If you have a chance of affecting the lives of so many of Jews and Israelis and affecting the life of us on the issue of Vienna and affecting the life of millions around the world by, for whatever reason, bringing together a certain diplomatic arrangement, of course you should do it. Now, what are the charges that are being leveled, which are, in my opinion, are childish or ridiculous even? One is that you're not in the position of taking such a role because you're too weak, you're too small state. Yes, we're not an empire, but certainly people are looking to us because there is trust in Mr. Bennett and there is trust in Mr. Lapid, which is quite remarkable. Second, people are taking the charge that we should be more adamant in our rebuke of the Russians and the moral conundrum which we are witnessing. Undoubtedly, this is a big dilemma, a huge thing that will come to our doorsteps, and we should not shy away from what needs to be said and done. Albeit, of course, the big question is, if we say and in more clear terms as what you suggest, and be much more adamant and say, you know, we cut our relation, we sanction so on, do we still have any leverage? Or we are about to see carnage and we don't have any word to say. This is what states do. I always write in my book, the state on the Jewish century, on the Israeli century. I said the Jewish century because it was written, it was a book by Mr. Sleskin in 2004 called The Jewish Century, whereby he defines that the American Jews will be much more important into the future. And my book, The Israeli Century, makes the point that Israel is the focal point of Jewish life into the future. And we have a role. And I also make a very strong point about the debate between American, especially liberal Jews and Israelis, between what I call the Jewish ethics of the liberal world, where you don't have to take any decisions on sovereign matters, and Israeli moral decisions, which are always come with the moral responsibility to take care of your state and your nation and your people. And this is, can we really reconcile these two? One is kind of amorphous and I would say even ideal. The other is the raison d'être, the reason of state, which is what we have to deal with. Now, this is indeed a serious issue that we have to contend with. It's not easy. And I understand also sometimes the criticism. But nevertheless, we have to make choices here. Cool-headed, not just verbal words, not just verbosity, but rather commitment to with an eye-opening opener, sort of like about what are the real challenges ahead of us. And these are immense challenges. And that's why I said what I said. And I think this is what it's all about. It's nice to be dressed only with the moral component. It's, of course, you know, people are suffering. There is the humane concern. We are helping. There is the issue of, you know, conquering another land.
I think that's very apt, by the way. I think that it's true that a lot of the criticisms that you see of Israel from diaspora Jews are often lacking that element of, like, actual responsibility for things that happen on the ground. So I think that is a very apt thesis. But I wanted to ask you, because you're talking about Israel's raison d'etre, and we're now talking in a time where there are thousands of Ukrainians, Ukrainian Jews or relatives of Jews who want to come and make Aliyah in order to escape the war. And there is a lot of talk about the government not quite being ready for them, not quite being prepared, and a bit of a mess in getting them here. So how do you think that Israel is fulfilling its, you know, raison d'etre in this war? Do you think that we're doing a good job?
First of all, and this is not because I'm a member of the coalition, we have begun working on this issue long before anyone else, perhaps. We understood the gravity of the threats. You know, there were lots of interpretations, whether they will attack, whether are they not going to attack. Will they attack after the Winter Games? Will they reach an agreement? Remember the visit of Macron. We saw the Chancellor of Germany. We see the give and take between the Americans. We were not, but we were preparing. We were warning our citizens to leave the Ukraine at this stage. We made all the efforts to bring the Israelis here. We also stationed many representative of Israel on all level, and people from of the Jewish people, organizations on the ground, which are now working around the clock to save people. We activated the foreign ministry around the clock again, an emergency rooms to work people. Only yesterday, I received in Adassa Hospital four members of the Jewish family in Kiev, which were hit by direct shelling, and we were making sort of arrangements to fly them over. And I did with Mada. We took them from the airport in Ben Gurion, brought them to Adassa. This is only one small example. Every day, hundreds are landing in Israel. The airplanes are leaving Ben Gurion empty and are coming full. And there is so much more to be done. We are talking about a calamity. We're talking about a flood of 2 million people already out of Ukraine. Just for the sake of comparison, I remember myself working many decades ago on the issue of the refugees after World War I and after the Russian Civil War, which is kind of like exactly 100 years ago. And at that time, I remember the numbers where people got Nansen passport were 2 million. We're already 2 million after a week. We see what happened. So we are working as diligent as possible. Mr. Bennett also appointed someone kind of a czar to coordinate. There is so many ministries are working. The finance minister is putting money. The absorption minister, Nativ, the joint, the all Jewish organizations. I don't want to miss all these.
Sorry, beyond the you know, the tactical Israeli angle of all of this. Your specialty as a political scientist and looking at international affairs and really one of the foremost, I would say, experts in Israel. I know a lot of the members of the Knesset were even your former students before you entered the Knesset just last year.
I hope they're still proud of their teacher when he's here.
Right. I hope they are too. I'm sure, but, you know, I'm sure you worked that out. Unfortunately, you no longer can give them a grade if they're not. But I'm curious, though, the larger picture, what does this do to the international order, right? This idea that Russia invades Ukraine, another ground war in Europe, the disintegration of NATO, maybe to an extent, the fact that, you know, as looking at this as a bystander, I say to myself, the whole world is trying to threaten him and trying to get him to stop, but then he doesn't stop and he goes in, and the ability to stop him once he's in is also limited. So there's sanctions and there's economic means. But what does this mean for the larger picture of where the world is potentially headed? Like, how do you understand that?
I think that what we are witnessing, and we can take it, let's say, 3 decades, and the quick shifts in world affairs, which are changing the possibilities and the arrangements of the international system. If in 1989, 99, 91, the world has moved from a bipolar world to a unipolar world with the United States at the helm and the Soviet Union crushed with its ideological component, we were supposed to be in a different world. And then we changed yet again for a variety of reasons. It was not the economy, stupid. When America was hit by September 11, that was the era of terror. I remember that. At that time, of course, and always in the picture, China, somewhere in the, you know, far away China. And Russia was not yet a player because Russia was disintegrating. Lo and behold, after what happened over the last 20 years, with the rise and demise of ISIS and the Arab kind of revolts and so on, so look what is happening. And the debates inside America, I cannot go through all of history right now. We see that the world is now kind of split. The two bodies are emerging. We don't know yet how. One is the West is coming as a unified, more unified body, and we see what happened to countries in Europe, many of which already thought that NATO itself is not important. And we remember also President Trump, speaking about that they have to pay their dues, they have to pay money to the organization. Suddenly, NATO is being revived, the whole idea of NATO. The Russian, of course, are trying to set a stage to a new division of labor between the United States, Russia, and China. China is kind of selecting its position, like India, for example, staying more kind of watching. This is something which is happening in front of our eyes. And I am sure that when all said and done, the world will not look the same. The very fact also that it was kind of like a silent threat or whatever language about nuclear weapons, we suddenly see the magnitude of the world coming from peaceful coexistence to almost on the verge of the abyss of world war. This can happen so quickly. And this is a reminder to everybody that the thesis that runs so deep in international affairs about what we call realism, where the world is anarchic kind of like arrangement. And when there is no direct kind of like, institution or a superpower that controls everything, things can really unfold and can really become very threatening. This is exactly where we are. Repositioning of power, repositioning of alliances, repositioning of world economy. We see the ripple effect on markets. We see the ripple effects on oil. We see it's so quick that we have to comprehend it, but it's undoubtedly the realist approach or neorealism that we are in an anarchic world order, that power grabbing and power is dictating lots of things is there. And the question of values will come back with vengeance. The question of America versus Russia and China, where we are all together. And we are in between. We have here made tremendous headways on the issue of peace in the Middle East. We with Arab countries, with more allies, but we constantly are affected by the global picture. And this global picture, we truly studying on a day-to-day level right now as we are watching it. And we're affecting it, not just watching passively speaking. And Israel itself, if we will get hundreds of thousands of newcomers, this will change again. Israel's face. We remember what happened after the Cold War when it had a massive migration of post-Soviet Jewry. We know. And of course, on other alliances, etc. We are now in the midst of the storm, if I can borrow the storm. We're in the midst of the storm, and we will see what will happen after that.
So from Ukraine to the other end of the Black Sea, right? We are tomorrow, well, as we're recording this, it's the day before President Herzog is going to go to Turkey. And that's sort of another interesting story in Israel's foreign relations and sort of the realignments of this part of the world, that we had such tensions and poor relations with Turkey for so many years, and there seems to be a rapprochement taking place now. What do you think that means?
Look, we haven't been in Turkey since the in good relation with Turkey since
the Marmara.
The Marmara, and lots of things have been deteriorated. Then we had the era of the rise of the Islamic State. And what happened with Turkey and Erdogan and so on, all is known. I think we have withstood the storm quite well. And I think Erdogan himself understood that he wants to try to make headways after he made Israel as the nemesis of Islam, the nemesis of Turkey. And many people kind of like, of course, we all took a step back. Now, this gingerly has to be arranged now. It's not just like lovey-dovey relations quickly after we had such a stormy separation. We also build new alliances during these changes. We have very, very strong relations with Cyprus and with Greece and with Egypt and with Jordan on a different level and when the people at the Gulf states. So Turkey understands Israel's position. Turkey has its own concerns. And I think Erdogan saw this as a chance of a new opening, inviting President Herzog, who does not represent directly the political system of Israel, but kind of a symbolic Israel, albeit, of course, Herzog is a very important diplomat for us in the world, and this government collaborate very, very closely with the Israeli president. So this is an important visit. It's a new opening, and it's very good to have a new opening. It doesn't come at the expense of our other alliances, it must be clear, but it's kind of like opening new venues. This government, to begin with, has worked to open new venues for Israel, not to close doors, but rather to open doors. And this is another door which is being opened. We open many doors, and we want to keep these channels open. We want to see what is happening. There can be, if there are good relations, there can be only benefits, of course, with clear eye. That sometimes things that we said can come at the expense of the other. We don't want that. We want to look very to see what will happen. And I think I'm much happier when a country like Turkey is inviting Israel and having his Israeli flag and president in Istanbul, rather than constantly just looking at us as the evil, the incarnation of evil. And it doesn't matter right now whether Erdogan went through a transformation of sort. No, this is international politics. This is realism, and that's what we are doing. We are doing our best, and we walk with timidity and with eye open.
I wanted to ask you also about China, right? And the lesson that China is getting from this whole experience here. There's been a lot of talk about Taiwan. I know you spent a lot of time researching and writing about China. So is this a real concern, do you think? And if that were to happen, again, is there anything the world would be able to do?
First of all, I think that the Chinese leadership and Chinese people are looking and seeing and like us. I don't want to get into the potential explosion in the Chinese sea. I don't want to get into predictions. You know, we read all in the papers. I think we know now, and we see also, and even though we see the power of Russia, we see also its limitation. We see also the power of the West. We see what happened when economic sanctions are being leveled. We see how predictions should be at least questioned and see. I don't think that the immediate parallels can be drawn to the behavior of China. China is undoubtedly the rising empire in the international system. And everything that you read, and I'm just reading everything that I can, an American system and the American decision makers, is the eye on China. The eye was not on Moscow. The eye was on China, where China is going. And this is, of course, raising this question about China, about Taiwan. You know, everybody's writing about it. I think that the lessons are not yet, as they say in English, the jury is not yet out, but very many lessons can really be drawn. The aggression in international affairs is a very, very tricky business. And one has to understand the consequences, and consequences are not necessarily those that you are planning. Lots of things can happen, and we are seeing. Look at what happened to the Russian ruble. Look what happened under this, sanctions. And look what happened in the position of sympathy and of legitimacy, all these terms in the international arena. Especially when this, you can say that the event, if I call it an event, did not end as quickly as they thought. You know, in international relations, people have like timetables. If you do things quickly, they're almost inevitable. If you do things not so quickly and the bloodshed is so increased, lots of other things can happen, and that's what we are witnessing right now. And the misery and the human toll and the destruction and is really changing minds and hearts. And I'm sure the Chinese themselves are watching very closely and looking at the shifts in international affairs. And every nation will have to choose eventually where they stand. And this is not a simple matter, just as India, which also kind of like have a good relation with China, it was with Russia, and it's a mega, mega state. But people are watching, and people are seeing, and people are kind of like grappling with the challenges.
We will continue to watch, as I'm sure you will. This has been fascinating. Professor Yossi Shane, member of Knesset from the Israel Beiteinu Party. And the world is shifting as right before our eyes. So we thank you for your insights, and thank you for being with the Jerusalem Post podcast.
First of all, I'm very grateful for this, for the Jerusalem Post, for hosting me. And I'm wishing you all the best, and just hoping that this conflict will come to a quick end, because the toll are amazing. And we are looking with tremendous concerns, and we have lots of things coming in the next few weeks on our doorstep. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speaking to you.
We're joined by Gil Hoffman, the Jerusalem Post's longtime veteran political analyst and correspondent. And Gil, we're talking because this week the Knesset is finally, after many long nights for you especially, but also for the Knesset members and some of the ministers, they are going on recess, and they need a break because they have been battling and fighting nonstop since they began and took office. So tell us what marked maybe this recent winter session of the Knesset. What can we expect into the recess, and what should we look forward to when they return, whenever that might be? You'll tell us when that happens.
Well, they come back on the 9th of May after Passover and Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel's Independence Day, and the coalition needs this recess desperately because they're floundering. They're not even passing bills that all eight parties in the coalition agree on, like term limits for the prime minister. The conversion bill, it was so important, it's not happening because they don't have a majority. Bennett needs to do something to build this coalition during the break, or they'll just continue to accomplish nothing other than not letting Netanyahu be prime minister.
I mean, why can't they pass these bills? I mean, you look at the term limits, and you said everyone agrees on it in the coalition. So what is going on there?
Okay, so in the term limits was stopped by it being a 61 majority needed for a bill that's part of the basic law, which is the forerunner to a constitution. So there the problem was COVID getting in the way. If you have one MK on either side who has COVID, then you're not going to have a majority, and that's a problem. But all the other bills that they're fighting over, it's internal fights inside the coalition, the left fighting the right. The right-wing parties in the coalition trying to cooperate with the opposition that hasn't been willing to cooperate except on the citizenship law that comes to a vote on Wednesday.
So what were some of the highlights, Gil, of this recent session? I mean, there were lots of votes that were lost, some that were won. There was chanting, there was dancing in the Knesset plenary. What are you taking away from these past few months of craziness?
They passed the state budget. That's what matters. So that they bought for themselves more time in power. In the end, nothing else matters. They'll continue fighting over minutia and everything. We're seeing Bennett not succeeding in rallying his troops, in bringing them together, in realizing that they have more in common than they have apart. We're seeing them not really being able to accomplish anything even basic. There was a victory party yesterday in the Likud faction, with them patting themselves on the back for all their successes. They said they passed more bills as an opposition than any opposition ever had before, and it's probably true.
Certainly true for the Netanyahu years. I mean, not to be too hard on Idit Silman, but we've seen some real coalition chair people like who have been managed to keep the coalition line really well, whether it's Zev Elkin, Yariv Levine, and she doesn't seem to be able to do it. I mean, what is the issue, that she's like a freshman Knesset member, or is the issue just the coalition itself is just too unwieldy?
Look, Naftali Bennett in high tech was a CEO, and this government needs a CEO. He's been behaving like a chairman. He's a figurehead when it comes to politics. He's tried to stay above the fray. He'd be more interested in going to Moscow and going to Berlin, then going to the plenum and actually working.
Doesn't that happen to all the prime ministers, though? I mean, wasn't that Bibi and Olmert and people before them? They don't like to spend time there. They don't like the fighting. They want the prestige, the gravitas.
Your Ariel Sharon especially hated going into the plenum. I mean, they had people who they could trust to do it for them, and Bennett doesn't. But he could be doing so much more. He could be getting his hands dirty, and he's chosen not to.
Why do you think that is? Why has he chosen not to? If his government has such a slim majority, right? They passed a budget, as you said, which is probably the most substantive thing that they've done, and that guarantees their continued survival for some time. But they find difficulty in passing legislation, right? They lose votes. They sometimes have to cancel votes. Every Knesset member is a king because they can revolt and then they can't pass the legislation that they want. Why doesn't he try a little harder, or he just doesn't think it's worth it?
He just has a longer way to go with only six seats. It's virtually impossible. Netanyahu was so smart in building up his relationship with the ultra-Orthodox that made him have 50 seats no matter what to pass anything, because as long as they got what they cared about in matters of religion and state, they would let him make the decisions on diplomacy, security, economy, the three issues that he cares about. That block was what's been governing our country now for 20 years. And it doesn't have that.
You probably get this question every other day, but how much time do you think this government has? Because it has become so dysfunctional.
I'm very much on record that I think something's going to happen in the summer of 2023 that would prevent the rotation with Yair Lapid from happening. You've got 80 right-wing members of Knesset, more if you count certain members of Knesset in blue and white, who don't want Lapid to become prime minister. And they don't want this Knesset to be replaced either. So there will be pressure within the Likud to replace Netanyahu, at least temporarily, with somebody else in Likud, whether it's Nir Barkat as the pollster or somebody else. Barkat constantly takes his own polls, which find that the Likud membership is getting more in line with the idea that getting the Likud back to power is more important than getting Netanyahu back to power. And the closer it looks like Yair Lapid will become prime minister, that pressure will increase. And I don't know whether Netanyahu will be able to withstand it.
What's the threat of Yair Lapid becoming prime minister? Is it ideological that they're opposed to, or is it that they fear that if he becomes prime minister, he could be someone who has staying power and won't leave for a long time?
No. It's ideological for the most part. Maybe they misunderstand what Lapid's ideology is, but they see him as favoring a Palestinian state and having traditional center-left views, even though Lapid has been denying that since he entered politics.
But I mean, but we've seen Likud sit with left-wing parties in the past. Like, why does Yair Lapid, who's more center, why does he upset them so much?
Have you seen the Likud play second fiddle in a coalition? They don't do that. That's what killed the Labour Party. Right. So they wouldn't sit under Lapid. And it was one thing to have Bennett, okay. He's right wing. They didn't like him. They didn't like losing power, but at least they lost power to a right wing prime minister, even though they pretend he's not. It's another thing to let Yair Lapid take over. Yair Lapid equals Palestinian state. Yair Lapid equals territorial concessions. Why allow that to happen if you've got 80 right wing members of Knesset? Why, for Bibi? This is when the Likud's and the right's patience with Netanyahu will suddenly be tested.
It's so hard for me to imagine at this point the Likud backing like away from Netanyahu when they're still standing by him this long. But Netanyahu himself seems a little like bored, right? Is it just me, or does he just doesn't seem like his heart is in it anymore? Even his comments on Iran, which is usually his favorite topic, like, you know, not as intense. Well, what do you think?
So I saw him on Monday in the Likud faction. He looked very excited at his party's success in this these last few months in the Knesset and stopping the coalition time and time again, cooperating with the Arabs to highlight the differences within the coalition. The BBTB team has been successful. And Yuli Edelstein came in and didn't have a seat at the table and looked really hesitant. And then a member of Knesset, Gadi Yavarkan, stood up from his seat at the table to give him the seat, which was very noble of him. Netanyahu is ready to pounce whenever given the opportunity. He's not politically dead. And between now and that time, as it gets closer to Lapid, when he'll be weaker, he will try to exploit anything he has to come back to power.
Do you think, though, that the Likud in any point would, as you said, get when it gets closer to the rotation in the summer of 2023, Likud would be of the position to finally have a race and finally get rid of him? You really think that's possible?
I think that over time, when that Lapid threat comes closer, it can happen, yeah. It would be seen as a temporary thing, a Medvedev kind of thing of what Putin did in having someone temporarily take over for him when he really controlled things from outside.
You would sort of like an Arya Derry thing.
Sure. I betrayed Arya Derry. But keep in mind that if they go to an election, then Lapid becomes prime minister for 6 months also. So, according to the coalition agreement, for the 3 to 4 months of the election, plus the 2 months it takes to form a government, that's very scary to the Likud rank and file. That pressure will come. And let's see how much the trial advances between now and
then. Gil, how is our sour defense minister doing, otherwise known as Benny Gantz, the guy who's always unhappy, never wanting to vote with the coalition, always kind of appearing to maybe be jumping ship and joining Likud? Is he a little happier these days? Has he come to terms with the fact that he's not prime minister? Where is he in all this?
I don't see Benny Gantz letting Yair Lapid become prime minister. He's very bitter. Even the pension bill that he threw a fit over, he accepted a pretty pathetic compromise, but it's only temporary. Then there'll be another fight over it until it's done. there is always this frustration lurking beneath the surface that threatens the coalition, that he can never really be taken for granted as a vote in favor. And he flexed his muscles more than anyone in this coalition has, even more than Mansour Abbas. Who would have thought?
Let's talk about Bennett's future. Is anybody going to vote for him again? Or is this it? He's going to go out in a blaze of glory as having been prime minister.
I don't see him becoming interior minister. Do you? You know, the coalition agreement says he's supposed to be interior minister.
Why? It's become a real important job now with the Ukrainian refugees.
I'll tell you, like with Bennett, though, there's something about him that's like very like earnest. Right. And like, I have trouble seeing him double crossing Lapid. Like, I'm probably being naive because like politicians double cross each other all the time. But it doesn't like suit like Bennett, as like we've all known him for like a decade now, to be a double crosser. So that's why I'm like, how's he going to get out of this? You know,
he did lie to his voters. Look, he's not married to Yair Lapid. He is married to Gilad Bennett. Gilad Bennett, I'm sure, would prefer that he start spending time with his children and make a lot of money in high tech.
Go on vacation to the Seychelles with them.
Correct. And so it wouldn't be Bennett that would double cross Lapid. It would be Yelich Aked, who's very happy to double cross Lapid.
So you predict that he's going to be stepping down. He's going to go out as prime minister. He's not going to go into the interior ministry.
I've thought it from the very beginning.
So what does Yair Lapid say about that then? Where is he in all of this? If you know that, he must know it. He must be thinking it if you're thinking it. So what's he thinking?
He says he trusts Bennett. And I can understand him trusting Bennett. He's done so much for Bennett. He got Bennett to be prime minister.
And what choice does he have?
Well, Lapid came to a conclusion with his brilliant strategist, Mark Mellman, that this is the way for him to come to power. And meanwhile, enjoy being foreign minister and called your excellency in countries around the world, including this week in Latvia. It's not a bad deal. It much beats being opposition leader and really in charge of nothing.
So, Gil, if you look at this Knesset, this coalition has been in office now for about 9 months, a little longer, maybe. What grade do you give them as they embark on their big recess over the holiday season?
Well, their goal was to be anyone with BB, and then that they get an A+. If they had a goal of accomplishing anything else, then they failed. And are they satisfied with being just anything but BB? The answer is yeah. It's a great accomplishment from their perspective.
Well, Gil, on that optimistic note, we're going to wish you farewell and thank you and let you have a night off after many endless long nights, sleepless nights, watching Knesset votes go into the wee hours of the morning as the coalition battled with the opposition to try to pass some legislation, not always with success. So thanks a lot, Gil.
Always a pleasure, Jakob and Laha.
Thanks for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. You can find us on all the platforms that carry podcasts and where you find your podcasts. And we hope you share this with your friends, family, and just maybe random people who might want to listen to what Lahav and I have to say and what some of our interviewees have to say. And we'll see you next week. Take care.